All right, so as your packet kind of shows there, we are kind of wrapping up Genesis with the last toledot here, the last section, the generations of Jacob. So that's going to incorporate chapters 37 to 50. And so this will largely revolve around kind of the sons of Jacob, right? So Jacob will still be involved in different aspects. But primarily focusing on the sons of Jacob, and particularly like Joseph, for example, will be a big name here. And so some events that might be hopefully familiar to a lot of you guys, but we'll go through all this. And my goal is the first half before our break, let's wrap up Genesis. All right, that's kind of the idea. But again, little review before we dive in here of just what we've been seeing recently in Genesis. So if you remember, we've been talking about the life of the patriarchs through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And through that, as these patriarchs, they are kind of that foundation of the nation of Israel. And that's really what we have seen, that God is establishing this foundation and these kind of core values that we see depicted in the lives of these individuals that will also be core values for the nation as a whole. Okay, so that will be for the nation of Israel as a whole. And so that's why, again, we view this as so foundational, is because to understand the nation of Israel later on in the Old Testament, so much goes back to the foundations being laid in like Genesis. Okay, and so if you remember, right, so in the life of Abraham, reminder with all this, right? We kind of, again, talk about laying that foundation, these core values. And you remember the two kind of main items the life of Abraham kind of dealt with, or what we learned from that?
Land.
Not quite. Well, that eventually would be part of it. What was that part of?
Promise.
The Abrahamic covenant? Okay. Covenant. So the Abrahamic covenant, which involved land, as we said. What else did it involve? The three kind of things?
Blessing.
And what's the third?
Trust. Nation or people.
Seed, yes. And then, so we see that aspect, but then also in the life of Abraham, we also saw what big picture? I think I heard it back here. Faith, right? Faith is that other. Yeah. I don't know. I thought I heard it, yeah. Don't be shy. So remember in the life of Abraham, so really we saw these two big items, the Abrahamic covenant, which included these, we kind of summarized the promises as land, seed, and blessing are all incorporated in that. And then also the element of faith. Okay, so Abraham is given these promises, these blessings, but then there's also that element of he has to then believe that, to trust God, to have faith. And so again, these two items will be critical for Israel's future as a nation as well. Okay, the Abrahamic covenant, as well as their faith, right? They need to believe. And then we saw through the life of Isaac and even Jacob, kind of both, kind of the main theme here with these guys and what we saw. Do you guys remember potentially what our theme was for those two, their lives? Guys on the spot. Something learned. We learned like this reality that God is with them, or like is with us kind of thing. So God is with them. So God is with them. And so we learn from their life that God will be with his people. He will fight for them on their behalf. And so we saw that in the life of Isaac. We saw especially in the life of Jacob. If you remember, as Jacob kind of schemed and did all his different things, God was at work to make sure it actually worked, that his plan continued forward. And that's also demonstrated in the name Israel, okay, which can be translated like God fights for us, right? Like kind of a thing, like God will fight for them. And so that's what we start to see unpacked. And so tonight, as we kind of get into this last toledot here, this last section where especially this focus on Joseph, even though it'll involve more than Joseph, I should probably just say like the sons of Jacob here, what the kind of the main theme that we're going to see in this is that the reality that God, keep like slanting down, like turn, God turns evil to good. And that should hopefully sound familiar if you remember the end of Genesis, where Joseph kind of makes that statement to his brothers, where he says, God, well, like, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, right? And so what we're going to see throughout this section is this reality that God works and turns evil to good. Okay, and we're going to see that as events unfold, as well as even people themselves, or people who are like wicked evil are turned to good and everything. Okay? And so really, all of these, like I mentioned, as the patriarchs and all these things, like, are going to be foundational to all of Israel as a nation as well in the future. And so I had one professor who kind of summarized how all these kind of values connect to where he made the statement of, that's what Israel is going to testify for the rest of their existence, is that because of the Abrahamic covenant, they are supposed to have faith in a God that is present and fighting to turn evil to good. Okay, let's say it one more time. So this is what Israel is going to testify for the rest of their existence, that because of the Abrahamic covenant, they are supposed to have faith in a God that is present and fighting to turn evil to good. And I feel like that's just a fitting kind of summary of how all that connects. Okay, and we'll see this big picture as well. Okay?
Also shows back, it kind of points back to Genesis like 3:15 as mm-hmm. well, right, with God himself.
Yep. Yeah, and that's what we're going to see, right? That even through, that includes all of this, right? And so not only is God working to turn evil to good, like in the life of like Joseph or others like that, but also even the fall itself, right? The fall, God is working to turn evil to good, right? And culminating in the future. Exactly. Awesome. All right, so let's get into our chapters. So the first kind of section here, again, chapter 37, we have this focus on Joseph and his dreams, okay? And do you guys kind of remember some of this? And actually, before we get into his dreams, real quick, verse 2, something to keep in mind here. How old is Joseph at this point?
17.
All right, so I think sometimes we like to view him as like this cute little kid going around, like he's an older teenager, all right? So he kind of knows what's up and what he's saying, right? So, all right, so if you guys remember, he has like kind of these dreams where he has like these, like the sheaves of grain that end up like the 11 sheaves of grain bow down to him, and then like the sun, moon, and stars, like they bow down to him, kind of a thing. And it's talking about like his brothers, and again, picture this teenager, right, coming and saying like, hey, I had this dream where you guys were all going to be bowing down to me. Do you think that go over well with your siblings? No, right? Like, that would not go over well. Okay. And so, right, this is not a good situation. And that's already on top of, if you guys remember, what else do we know about Joseph specifically, right? One of the main things is that, what, like, his father loved him the most, right? And we see that in this section where verse 3, like it says, like, now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Okay, so like it makes that pretty clear. And what in this verse kind of also showed that? What did he give him? Do you guys remember? Yeah, a robe, all right, the cloak, all that. And so that kind of represented that. And even real quick, like even before that, before he gave that robe, we'll come back to that. Do you guys remember what else like showed that he loved him from last week? Of what did Jacob do that pretty much showed that he loved Joseph more than his sons? Yeah, do you remember when he's about to meet Esau and one of his strategies was kind of like, I'm going to line you guys up essentially by like how much I love you, because if Esau starts attacking, like I'll put whoever is most loved in the back just so they have a better chance to get away. And so again, if you're the first one walking out, you're like, oh, I know where I am, right? Like that's not good. And I'm sure, do you think like if you were a sibling of Joseph, would you have forgot that? Like I was kind of like your human shield for you, right? Like that's kind of was my role when we're facing Esau. So that probably wouldn't have gone over too well, right? That would have stuck in their mind. And then now you have their father also giving him this robe. And really the idea, like I know there's like the Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat, all that, right? The kind of literal translation here is more of like a long-sleeved robe or a long-sleeved garment We don't know if it was like many colors. That's like from the Septuagint translation and the Vulgate, Latin Vulgate, kind of make these statements of many colors. So it could have been. We don't know for sure. But the idea is this long sleeve cloak, which based on like 2 Samuel 13 verse 18 kind of seems to tie in with royalty kind of a thing. And so that's like the importance of this robe. And so this seems to kind of suggest, like if you remember part of the theme of Genesis, as it's that kind of tracking down who like the seed will be, who the promised seed is, as well as like who, like through what line the seed will be. And so even with now with Joseph or with Jacob and his 12 sons, the question is like, well, who's the line of the seed going to go through? Now you have 12, like who's that going to be? And so what this seems to suggest is who seems to get Jacob's vote? Joseph, right? Like he kind of thinks this is the guy, right? This is the one. And that seems to be what's kind of by this giving of the garment as well, kind of clearly indicating that. All right. And so all this is combined to where Joseph tells them these dreams. And again, they are not happy. They are angry about this because of all this going on, right? All right. So that then leads to, again, this story where as the brothers are out shepherding their flock one day, Jacob sends Joseph to go check on them, all that. And then do you remember as he approaches, do you remember what they decide to do?
Kill him.
Yeah, they're like, let's kill him. Let's kill him and throw him in a pit, right? Essentially is what they decide to do. As he's coming, they say, okay, let's just get rid of this guy and we'll do all that. But do you remember who kind of first chimes in with this to kind of maybe like, hey, let's not do this? You guys remember who does it first? Yeah, Reuben, okay. And you guys remember what I kind of mentioned about him last week as well? What's he kind of now? Chance. Yeah, he's like the disgraced firstborn. Like he's like kind of like the wannabe firstborn where he tried to remember he slept with his father's concubine as kind of this showing of kind of that either one, he's trying to usurp that authority or to essentially try to show that dominance of like, I am the firstborn. I'm going to be the one who receives the birthrights, all these things. Like I'm the guy. But in actually doing that, he actually disqualifies himself from that. But as I mentioned, like he's going to keep trying to like be that guy. And this is another example of that where he kind of steps up and says, like, gives this plan of kind of like, hey, like, let's not kill him. Let's just like throw him in a pit, okay? And not actually like harm him in that way. We just leave him and, you know, it's still pretty bad, right? But do you remember what his reasoning was for that? Was he actually just going to leave Joseph there?
He wanted to be the one to return him to his father.
Yeah, he was going to go like rescue him and like bring him back and like, hey, look it, I saved your favorite son. Like, and so that hope of kind of restoring his status, okay? That's kind of his kind of goal in all this. So it wasn't just that he really cared for Joseph and he's trying to protect him. It's what? He's trying to, again, be that firstborn that establish his kind of role there. But, you know, the story, as they're sitting there, they see this caravan of merchants coming along that are heading down to Egypt. And then we need to notice something important here, because then they have this idea, right, to sell Joseph to these merchants. And do you remember whose idea that was?
Judah.
Yeah, Judah. Okay, so you now have Judah come on the scene here, and he suggests this plan, and all the brothers listen, right? They listen to it, they go along with it, and so who do you start to see as the real leader here of these sons? It's Judah, right? Because what, Reuben, like his plan doesn't really get listened to. They kind of abort on it. It's not Joseph because he's like in a pit, right? Like he's not leading, okay? So he's not the one. But really it's Judah. And what do we see about Judah at this point? Is he wicked or good? Wicked, right? Like this isn't a good thing he's doing, right? Like, I mean, potentially better than murdering his brother, right? But like, at least, but it's still not good, okay? And so he is... Yeah, he might make some money, yeah, all that, right? And so, again, like, so he is wicked. And so this is something God is going to have to change. And just like we mentioned, this kind of theme of God turning evil to good, that involves also people. All right. And so we're going to have to see how God kind of works in the life of Judah as well. And so you're going to actually see that taking place alongside Joseph as well. Okay. Okay, so the brothers go through this plan and all that. And then do you remember the kind of, story they kind of give their father Jacob of what happened to him? What happened to Joseph?
They
dipped his nice robe in some blood and they said, well, like the wild animals got him, right? And you can't miss kind of that connection of Jacob here being deceived by clothing and stuff, because what did Jacob do in the past? He deceived Isaac with clothing, right? Like he put on Esau stuff, all that. And so kind of an ironic twist, he's getting deceived in a similar fashion. All right. So see, gets sold into slavery, all that. But then in chapter 38, again, we have this kind of story here with Judah. And you can start to see, based on the last chapter, of Judah as that leader, of why Scripture takes the time to focus on Judah a little bit here. And so that's why you have this. And we once again see the reality of Judah's wickedness on display, something that's going to need to change ultimately. And so kind of what ends up happening, so we see his wickedness kind of in his interactions with his family. We're not going to go into all these details. We got to move quicker. This ultimate example of his wickedness we see in how he interacts with his family, as well as after his wife dies, he ends up sleeping with his daughter-in-law, thinking she is a cult prostitute. That's not much better, right? Like, it's not good. But then when it is found out that like his daughter-in-law is pregnant, he is very quick to want to condemn her to death. And he's like, yeah, this, we need a judgment on this and everything. But then she kind of reveals that, hey, you're actually the father. You're the one. And he just kind of like drops the whole thing. Right? Like, oh, okay, never mind. Right? Like, let's sweep this under the rug a little bit here. And so what you kind of find in this account, what's important for us to like keep in mind here, is that not only is Judah like wicked, right? He's still wicked in this point, but we also see the reality that he doesn't really take responsibility in any way that will potentially come back on him or harm him, right? Like he doesn't want to take any sort of responsibility for anything that might potentially kind of come back to hurt him or harm him or damage him in any way. Okay? Like, for example, like even with the selling of Joseph, what was his reasoning of why should we do this rather than just kill him? He's like, well, that way, like, the blood's not on our hands. Like, and so he's again, like, just kind of like, well, we can just say, like, well, we had nothing to do with it. Like, we just sold him. Like, we don't know if he died or whatever. Like, blood's not on our hands by doing this. Okay? And he does kind of the same thing when he finds out that his daughter-in-law is pregnant, and he's the one that's kind of like, well, like, whatever, let's just kind of sweep this under the rug. Let's not really deal with it. Okay, and so he doesn't really take responsibility. And what we're going to see through these chapters is this is going to be like the primary way God is going to work in changing him, and this idea of turning evil to good. And this is going to be one of the main ways we see that demonstrated, is in this area of this kind of taking responsibility and owning up for things, okay, is kind of what we're going to see. All right, but back to Joseph. So back to Joseph, we are now in Egypt. So Joseph has taken to Egypt, sold into slavery there, and he ends up in the house of Potiphar. And so what we know about Potiphar is he is an officer of Pharaoh, a captain of the guard, and we don't know for sure what Potiphar's role was as the captain of the guard. But some people speculate and argue that he might have actually been like the chief executioner for Pharaoh, which it would explain like why he has like a prison in his house. That wasn't like normal Egypt of just like, oh yeah, there's also our prison room over here, right? Like that's not what it was. And so people argue that he might have been actually like the chief executioner for Pharaoh. Okay, so kind of a big deal with this. And so notice, though, as Joseph kind of works in this house, the Lord causes him to prosper. And Potiphar, what? He notices this kind of prosperity that's happening. And so then what's he do? He makes Joseph the overseer of his house, gives him all this responsibility. And so you see the Lord then blessing Potiphar's house. And so, again, can't miss. What is that connecting back to? This idea of blessing those who bless God's people, right? Like, what's that connect back to? What was that part of? Yeah, the Abrahamic covenant, right? Abrahamic covenant, this idea where, again, that promise to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you. And we see that unfolding still here, like in the life of Joseph, where Potiphar sees that God blesses this guy, and so he deals well with him, and God blesses Potiphar's house. And so we see that continue to unfold. But then the whole situation happens with Potiphar's wife. That whole thing goes down where, again, she tries to like seduce Joseph, but he flees, and then she lies to her husband about what happened. And do you remember what Potiphar does in response to that? Yeah, throws him in prison, right? Probably like that prison in his house, right, kind of a thing. What would you probably like expect him to actually do?
Kill him,
right? And who would have been the perfect person to do that?
Him,
the chief executioner, right? Like, he's the prime guy for the job. But the fact that he throws kind of Joseph in prison instead may reveal what, like, one, like, he probably values Joseph, right? He values him a lot. But then also, might not fully believe his wife, right? Like, might not fully believe that, okay? And this also is supported because, what, when he throws him in the prison, what does he actually end up doing with Joseph while he's in prison? What role does he give him? Yeah, he's like, hey, can you oversee the prison for me, right? Like, things went well, like, upstairs, right? Like, I think things will go well in the prison, too. And so, again, you see, he gives him, like, puts him in charge of the prisoners in the prison. And so, again, you see this element that Potiphar might actually value him and, again, might not fully believe the wife in that way. All right. And so we have Joseph in prison and potentially in prison for up to about 10 years. And it will be in this time that God will continue to refine and grow him, all right, in different ways. And so primarily, like, in humility, right, as we've seen. And so we see this happening here, all right? All right, and then that leads to chapter 40, where we see kind of Joseph's interaction with a couple of prisoners, the cupbearer and the baker. And so, remember, they're thrown in prison, they're there with him, and then they both have some dreams, and then they tell Joseph their dreams, and Joseph interprets them for them, and he kind of makes these statements, right, that he tells the cupbearer, like, cupbearer goes first and tells him, like, oh, this dream means, like, in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore him to his position, right? He's restored to the position that he has, and so great news, that's awesome. And so the baker, hearing that, is kind of like, oh, well, here's mine, because it kind of seems kind of similar, so here's my dream, and Joseph tells him, and there's kind of a play on words here, where in contrast to the cupbearer, where it's like, yeah, he'll lift up your head in this idea of, like, restoring. This one instead, it says, like, and in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head off of you, right? Like, essentially is the play on words, and so he will be executed. And so all those situations come to pass. Those things happen just as Joseph interpreted. And then at the end, do you remember what does Joseph ask the cupbearer to do as he's restored his position?
Remember.
Yeah, he's like, remember me, right? I'm like, put in a good word for the Pharaoh, right? Like, help me out. But what do we see happen? Does the cupbearer remember? No. No, he kind of forgets, right? Until a couple of years later, okay? So, again, he kind of forgets, and Joseph will have to wait kind of another couple years in prison. But again, God is continuing to refine him through this, okay? But then we see Pharaoh has his own dreams that he then needs interpreted, and no one can help him in interpreting that. And that is the event that kind of sparks the memory of the cupbearer, where he's like, oh yeah, I know a guy. That's all right. Remember this guy. And so it tells him about Joseph and all that. And so if you remember, Pharaoh's dreams has to do with those, like the seven plump and attractive cows are followed then by like kind of sickly, they're swallowed up by seven ugly thin cows. And then there's like the 7 years of grain that are all plump and good, and they're swallowed up by 7 years of grain that are thin and blighted and all that. And so Pharaoh's like, what is going on? What does this mean? And so Joseph is summoned, okay? And in chapter 41, in verse 14, just notice something that we need to hold in our mind for a little bit. Before he goes to Pharaoh, what does he do? See that in verse 14? What does he do? Yeah, he shaves, all right? So keep that in your mind. We'll come back to that, but that's just a little nugget to keep in there. So he shaves. But we see, right, he comes and interprets Pharaoh's dreams. And notice in verse 16, Joseph's, like, humility kind of becoming more on display here. Where what does he say? Like, that it's, it's not in me, but God will give a favorable answer, right? Like, he's understanding, right? This isn't like me. This isn't my own abilities or whatever. This is God at work here. And so we see him giving that credit to God. And so again, we see that refinement happening. That's good. And then what does Joseph say? What's the interpretation? That essentially what? There's going to be 7 years of kind of plenty. The harvest will be good, all that. But then it's going to be followed by 7 years of famine. And so then Joseph kind of gives his plan of what should kind of be done to prepare for all this. And that pleases Pharaoh. And so Pharaoh's like, all right, let's do it. Like, and he agrees and goes along with it. And that and then leads to Joseph rising in power, where Pharaoh essentially makes him number two in the nation outside of just himself. And so, again, we see God using Joseph to bring blessing to Egypt as well as to other nations as the famine kind of happens. And again, this ties into the idea of what? God using his nation as like a blessing, right? To not only bless those who bless you, but also what? Being a blessing to all the nations, just like was promised to Abraham. And we see that on display. All right. And so we've seen kind of Joseph being refined and changed at this point. And the question is then, what about his brothers? Have they changed at all? Or where are they at? What's going on with them? And so we have them kind of come back on the scene here in chapter 42. And this is where the brothers, there's a famine, right? This famine is hitting just as Joseph had interpreted the dreams. And this is not just in Egypt. This is in all the surrounding lands as well. It hits everyone hard. And so Joseph's brothers end up being sent by Jacob to Egypt to go get some food. Okay. And as they do, they go up there. Who do they encounter? Joseph. But they don't recognize him, right? Like, they don't recognize him. He recognizes them. He knows for sure who they are, but they don't recognize him. And if you remember, Joseph then does what? He kind of accuses them of being spies in the land. And then you remember, what does he ask them for proof as to who they say they are? Like, they kind of tell them their background a little bit, but then what does he say? Like, I want this as proof of who you say that you are. Yeah. Bring your youngest brother, Benjamin, right? Bring your youngest brother to me. Why do you think he asked for that? Huh? Okay, he liked Benjamin? Yeah. What else?
He wanted to see if they would just do it again.
Yeah. Yeah, they want to see, like, have they actually changed, right? Have you actually changed? Or, like, is Benjamin actually, is he still alive, right? Like, I'm not going to take your word for it, right? Like, is he still alive, or did you do the same thing to him that you did to me? Like, yeah, did you get rid of him? Like, throw him in a pit? Is he still out there somewhere? And so he demands what? Benjamin be brought to him, okay? He wants to know if they've actually changed at all. All right. And so, right, he holds back Simeon, all that, as kind of this person to keep back here just so they will come back, okay? And he essentially tells them, like, hey, don't come back again unless you also bring Benjamin, okay? That's like that proof. And so he sends the rest back, He also puts like their money back in their sacks and all that. And when they find it, they're kind of afraid about that, like, what just happened. And then they recount to Jacob all that happened and explain to him, like, hey, if we need more food, we got to bring Benjamin. Okay. And do you think Jacob really wants to do that? No. It's like, last time I sent a son to you, right? Like, that didn't end up well, okay? So I don't know if he's very trusting. But then notice something that happens here at the end of chapter 42 that's important. Because then who steps up to try to convince Jacob here to send Benjamin with them? Reuben, right? Back on the scene again. And so again, what do we know about him? He's like that wannabe firstborn trying to establish his dominance. And so what's he kind of say? He kind of offers this plan essentially of, hey, like, send Benjamin Lee. I will guarantee his safety. And if he doesn't come back safe, what does he like offer in return? Yeah, you can kill my two sons. Okay, so issues with that, right? First off, like, Reuben kind of semi gets off scot-free, like a little bit here, right? Where he's just kind of like, okay, no harm on him necessarily. But then two, who are Reuben's sons in relation to Jacob? His grandchildren. So then you'd be like, oh yeah, for sure. I want to kill my grandkids. Like, that sounds like a good trade, right? Like, no, this is a bad idea, okay? And so, does Jacob listen to this plan? No, right? He rejects it. And once again, you see Reuben, like, trying to be that leader, but he's really not. Okay, it's not really working out, not falling through here. Okay? All right, but the famine continues. They need food. And so what? They have to go for a second visit. And again, they need to bring who? Benjamin with them. And so they got to convince Jacob, chapter 43. But then this time, who steps up? Judah. Okay, and again, we see him as this leader. And so notice verse 9 here of chapter 43, where what's he say? He says, I will be a pledge of his safety. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. Okay, and so remember, what did we say about Judah before? What did he not want to do before? Take responsibility. What's he doing now? Taking responsibility. All right, he says, let it be on me. And all that. And he says, let me bear the blame forever. Literally, that blame is like the same word for like sin. So almost like, let me be as sin to you forever, which in kind of a honor shame culture that Israel is, that's a huge deal to say, like, I'm going to bear that shame essentially for the rest of my life. I'll bear that. And almost kind of to some extent, in that culture, like, dying is like the easier way out. Right? To where like living with that shame for the rest of your life is like almost a harder thing. And so this is a big deal that he is stepping up in this way, saying this. And so we start to see that he has kind of changed, right? There is some change in him. Okay. So Jacob agrees. So again, showing Judah is that leader. Jacob actually agrees to it. And they all travel down to Egypt. All right. And so we have, again, this interaction. Joseph then tests his brothers. So he kind of orchestrates this test where, yeah, they see Benjamin, all this stuff. But then, what, he sends the brothers off with food, puts their money back, but then he also puts, like, the silver cup in Benjamin's bag and all that. And he sends one of his messengers to kind of hunt him down and, like, hey, you guys stole this cup. They're like, oh, we didn't. But they find him in Benjamin's bag. And so they all head back to Joseph. And what does Joseph declare, right? He's like, hey, I will only take Benjamin to be my servant because, well, like, it was, he's the one that the cup was found in his bag. I only need him. And so again, what is Joseph doing here? Testing them. Are you going to do the same thing? Will they actually defend Benjamin, or are they just kind of like, oh, okay, that's nice. Yeah, take Benjamin. That's cool. Like, we didn't really like him anyways. Like, do they just kind of do that same thing or not? What do they do? But then notice verse 18 here of chapter 44. Who steps up again? Judah. Okay, Judah goes up to him and he kind of recounts the conversation they had with each other last time, all that. recounts the conversation he had with his father, Jacob, and then that he would be like the pledge of Benjamin's safety, all that. And then look at verse 33, where it says, like, "Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers." So what does Judah offer to do? To be that substitute, right? To be that substitute. I will take his place. Like, I will be the one to stay behind. Let this other boy go. Let our brother go. Okay? And that's huge, right? Because, again, you start to see this idea of this substitution, right? Kind of taking place. And why could he be that fitting substitute? Because he's the what? The leader. Right? He's the leader of this group. And this comes back to what we kind of mentioned before, that word of like this idea of corporate solidarity, right? Where the actions of the leader can be that substitute for the many. And so as the leader, this would be a fair exchange. Okay? And so as we go through, like, again, this is establishing foundations. And so as we go through Israel's history, this ability of like this kind of corporate solidarity is tied in really with what it means to be a king, okay? Because a king, as kind of the leader of the nation, can be kind of that substitute for the nation, essentially. And as we'll see in a little bit here, do you guys know who the line of the kings comes through? Judah. Okay, through his line. And so it's all starting to make sense. It's all tying together that Judah is demonstrating what a true leader and what eventually a true king should look like. One who has that corporate solidarity with his people, and as such can be a substitute for his people. And so, when that's the case, this is what a true leader, a true king is. And what do we see ultimately unfold later on is what? Jesus' substitution on the cross. And why can he do that? Because he is the what? True king, the true leader. He can be the substitute for his people, right? Like, so there's all this link kind of happening. Okay, so that makes sense. And we're establishing these foundations in Genesis. All right, and so we see Judah has changed. He takes responsibility. And then we come into chapter 45. And really, as we come into this, right, like, who is responsible for this change, right? It's God, okay? He is still working to turn what? Evil to good. That's what we're seeing here. And so in chapter 45, we have the reveal where at this point, what? Joseph can't really hold back any longer, sends out all the everyone except his brothers. And what's he say in verse 3? What? I am Joseph, right? Reveals himself to his brothers, which probably is a very shocking and terrifying moment for his brothers, I'm sure, kind of that. And again, you can't miss kind of the emotion, the shock factor of that. I think when we hear stories so often, we lose sight of that. I heard one like sermon one time message that someone equated almost to like kind of in shocking nature is like the reveal in Star Wars when like Darth Vader revealed like, "I'm your father, Luke, I'm your father." And yeah, for us where you've heard it a lot, maybe you're like, oh yeah, everyone knows that. But imagine like, I don't know, yeah, people hear that probably alive when that actually like happened, right? Was that pretty shocking? Not directly. There's multiple. But I would imagine that was pretty shocking twist, right? No one saw that coming. So like in that same way, right? This is like the emotion, the picture here is this shocking twist for them of like, what? Like, this is Joseph, right? Like, and so you can't miss kind of all that emotion kind of embedded here. And so, again, they kind of weep together. Joseph tells them all of what God has done in all this. And we see that since Pharaoh values Joseph, we see that still on display. He tells Joseph to send for his father and have his whole family come and dwell in Egypt. And that's what happens. Okay, so the brothers return to Jacob, tell him that Joseph is still alive, and he believes them, and they begin to head down to Egypt. And so they journey to Egypt. But notice, at the beginning of chapter 46, the Lord appears to Jacob. And he kind of assures him here, calls out to him and says, "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you a great nation. Why would the Lord need to tell Jacob of like not to be afraid to go down to Egypt? Yeah, he knew from what? Abraham, Isaac, like, don't leave the land. That's not a good thing. Don't leave the land. Bad things. But what? God says, no, this is part of the plan. Okay, this is part of the plan. Go down. This is where I'm going to make you a great nation. And remember, this ties in also to kind of that prophecy where the Lord told Abraham, what? That his descendants would be in a foreign land for 400 years and be afflicted and all that, and he'd bring them out. So this is all tying, kind of setting the stage for all of that, okay? And so they come to land, settle in Egypt, in the land of Goshen. Okay, all that. And then we see kind of this blessing in Egypt where Jacob meets Pharaoh, blesses him. Again, tying into the idea of in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And then we see also the Egyptian people kind of selling everything to Pharaoh in order to receive food and kind of all those things. But then notice, verse 27 of chapter 47 here, where in contrast to the Egyptians, who are kind of like selling all their stuff, all that. Notice in verse 27, it says, Israel settled in the land of Goshen and they gained possessions in it. So they're growing and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. And where have we seen that phraseology of the being fruitful and multiplying? Yeah, like creation, right? That was also reiterated with like Noah and all that. Like, and so again, God showing his plan is still on track. It's still going. It's on track. We're good, right? That's what's happening. Then chapter 48, you have Jacob blessing Ephraim and Manasseh, which are the sons of Joseph. And even in this, you have these two kind of sons like will function as kind of this double portion essentially for Joseph, where they will be the ones who will be the tribes of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, rather than a tribe of Joseph. Okay. But we also see again an example of God's kind of his own election here, where do you remember which of the two sons he gives the blessing to? Yeah, the younger, which was Ephraim. All right, so Joseph's like, hey, what are you doing? Like, so like cross his hands, right, remember? Kind of fake out there. But we see, again, God electing in that. All right. Okay, let's see. Yeah, let's finish Genesis before we take a break. So then chapter 49. I mean, you have Jacob bless the rest of his sons. And we don't have time to go through like all these in detail, but we'll focus on just kind of the main one here and a couple real quick. But again, we have to remember that these 12 sons will eventually become what? The 12 tribes of Israel. Okay, and so this will have impact for the nation down the road as well into the future. And so kind of goes in order of kind of the birth order in some sense, right? Where who was addressed first? Reuben. And we kind of find out here, like affirming what we've known all along, where he is disqualified from having preeminence, which we said before because of his sin and all that. So again, he's not the one that the line of the seed will go through. Then you have Simeon and Levi mentioned, and it talks about like in kind of how they messed up with the people of Shechem, where again, remember, they kind of slaughtered the whole town when they kind of went beyond the scope of the judgment that needed to be rendered. And so they kind of disqualified themselves as well and would be then scattered throughout Israel. And then we come to Judah, okay, which is important. Like, these are like the important chunk here, because remember, Judah is the leader, and we see that kind of affirmed here. And we need to pay particular attention to verse 10 of chapter 49, where it says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." And so notice that first part there, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet." That is the clear indication that what? He'll be the line of the kings. Okay, the kings will come through his line. He is the kingly line. And so we see that confirmed again, the leader of Israel, essentially, right? That line is the line of Judah. But then we have this next phrase, this like some translations like mine says like until tribute comes to him, or some might say until he to whom it belongs shall come. But literally, what that phrase is in Hebrew is until Shiloh comes. Okay, until Shiloh comes. And so, like, I don't like, I have a footnote in ESV that kind of mentions that as well. But that's literally kind of what this translates to, is until Shiloh comes. And Shiloh, that term there is kind of one who is connected with peace and will bring peace, okay? Like, it has like the same root for that term for peace, like for like shalom, right? Because if you've heard shalom, that term of peace in Hebrew, it's that same kind of root there. And so the idea is this Shiloh, this person has some connection of with peace and bringing peace, all right? And so, which again seems to be picked up later on, like in Isaiah 9:6, do you remember like the Messiah is referred to as what? The Prince of Peace, okay? And which refers to that Messiah. And so we see the Shiloh will be from the royal line, okay? And will bring peace. And notice what else? And to him what? Shall be the obedience of all the peoples, or of the peoples. And the peoples indicates that this is referring to what? The whole world. That's like the nations, essentially. And so again, you see this connecting with the Abrahamic covenant, which that had what? Worldwide ramifications. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. It'll have a worldwide effect. And so this is, we see that how is that going to unfold? It's going to be through this Shiloh that this worldwide effect is going to come about. Okay? And so it's through this one who will bring peace, this guy, okay, this individual, this kind of peacemaker in a sense, okay? And so this Shiloh will fulfill the Abrahamic covenant. And again, remember all that that is tied into as well. Remember we talked about the Abrahamic covenant that was linked to what? Like the Noahic covenant, the blessing of creation. And so it'll be through this Shiloh that we can get back to the original creation and to that blessing and rest that we saw. Okay? So it's all linked to this person. Okay? All right. And then we see kind of the death of Jacob here, where Jacob dies. There's weeping for him. But also notice, besides his family, who else weeps? Him, do you guys remember? The Egyptians actually do, right? The Egyptians, they weep for him as well. And shows they did value Jacob. And so they're actually weeping there. And really that starts to put Israel on display, even to like the Canaanites who notice this great mourning of the Egyptians. And so they bury Jacob back in the land of Canaan, and then they all return to Egypt. And then you have this kind of last conversation with Joseph and his brothers, where they're kind of afraid of, oh, our father died. Maybe he's going to like kind of seek his revenge on us finally now and all these things. But then this is where we have that kind of famous line that then is our fitting theme for this section, right? Where Joseph tells them what? You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, right? He has turned it all. And we've seen that unfold already in all the lives of these individuals and how God has orchestrated all these events. But we see that on display here. He is the God who turns evil to good, which includes everything from like the fall on, right? Everything. He is working to turn all that to good as well. And lastly, to wrap up Genesis, Joseph dies. But notice, where is Joseph buried? You guys remember? Like country. Yeah, in Egypt, right? He's buried in Egypt. And so before he dies, he asks that, what? When God brings his people back to the land, the promised land, that what? They would bring his bones with them and bury him in the land that God had promised them. And this is the reminder that what? They need to get back. They need to get back to the land that's part of Abrahamic covenant, land seed blessing, right? The land portion. They need to get back. And so this sets the stage for how is that going to happen? The Exodus, right? And that's where we get into Exodus. And so we'll take a break and then we'll pick up with Exodus in a few minutes here.